I'd like to reflect a bit on what I would give as a title, Zen and the Quaker Art of Making Decisions. Now, in my own life, to the extent that I'm successful, I try to draw on two different traditions, spiritual traditions, that I have some familiarity with. One, of course, is Zen. The other is the Society of Friends, or Quakers. I find the two approaches have both similarities and differences. Two of the similarities that I find are, one, a respect for the power and the healing capacity and the insightful capacity of silence. Both traditions honor silent meditation. And secondly, a shared belief that each of us contains what we might call the seed of the universal, and thus the potential for doing good, as well as more specific parts of us, so that both traditions see the possibility of ameliorating the pain and suffering in the world by transcending ego-driven forces that are also parts of ourselves. And for the Quakers, it may be, or the formulation is in terms of getting in touch with that of God or that of the divine within us, or for, of course, the Zen tradition to access the Buddha nature that we all have within us. I tend to think of it simply as just accessing our shared humanity, that which we all share as being human beings. Now, recently I've had to make the most agonizing decision of my life, which was to place my wife Carol Ann in residential care after a long and ever-changing period in our lives, which eventually made things very difficult and potentially unsafe, probably for both her and for me. Fortunately, I have two grown sons who were able to provide wise counsel and help to make a consensual decision that we all thought was for the best, even if it was, well, the least worst of the possibilities that confronted us. Now, along the way, for guidance, I was able to access two Quaker traditions. One is called the Clearness Committee. It goes back, evidently, to the 17th century. In the words of a very thoughtful practitioner, the Clearness Committee is testimony to the fact that there are no external authorities on life's deepest issues. Not clergy, or therapists, or scholars. There is only the authority that lies within each of us waiting to be heard. Behind the Clearness Committee is a simple but crucial conviction. Each of us has an inner teacher, a voice of truth that offers the guidance and power we need to deal with our problems. But the inner voice is often garbled by various kinds of inward and outward interference. So how it works is that the focal person, in this case myself, identifies several members of the worshiping community in whom he or she has a great deal of trust, to put a question, or to identify a question, talk a little bit about what the focal person has been thinking and feeling so far, with the rest of the group listening in absolute silence, then reflecting or summarizing what they've heard, and perhaps asking questions of the focal person. Suggestions or advice are not permitted. It's a very intensive listening exercise. Now, as I was preparing for the session, I just happened on something in a little booklet, which is often available, with the quaint 17th century title of Advices and Queries, that can provide guidance in the form of questions. And I just happened to glance at one of them, which I had never read before. It's not a booklet or a series of questions I spend a lot of time with, though I think I now should. And this one happened to read, "Every stage of our lives offers fresh opportunities. Responding to divine guidance, try to discern the right time to undertake or relinquish responsibilities without undue pride or guilt. Attend to what love requires of you, which may not be great busyness." Now, in that couple of sentences, well, there's a great deal of wisdom, it seems to me. And I'd like to unpack it. Talks about life stages providing opportunities. There are various times in our lives, or continuously, that change, of course, is offered and may or may not occur. And we have the opportunity to guide whatever changes are needed or not needed. That's going to be, obviously, with respect to relationships, whom I want to be close to, whom I perhaps do not want to be close to, what kind of career, what kind of education, how to raise children if we happen to have them. Lots of opportunities in which to either undertake or relinquish responsibilities. Maybe adding something, we should be doing this. Maybe I should pack my bags and move from California to Melbourne, which we did at one point. Often we concentrate on adding, I think, which can sometimes result in overburdening ourselves and shortchanging ourselves. Relinquishing is as important as undertaking. The query talks about pride or guilt. That can be in our own eyes or in the eyes of others, the self or others. What would people think of me if I do such and such? How would I feel if I do such and such? So in this case that I'm talking about, I'm relinquishing personal care after a period of trying as hard as I could to provide it. I was proud of being able to provide that personal care, and I felt guilty in relinquishing it. It's very hard to do. I'm giving up. Am I letting somebody else down? Am I letting myself down? I hadn't thought in terms of pride, guilt perhaps. I can do this myself. I know I can. Other people have, maybe. I don't know. I can. Letting go, relinquishing that pride as well. And perhaps the most important word for me at the end was busyness. Attend to what love requires of you, which may not be great busyness. I find I'm inclined to be very busy and to be proud of that. Probably less so now than I used to be. And how often do I say or hear other people say, oh, I'm just so busy doing this and enumerating, it's that. Boy, I must be doing a good job with my life because I'm so busy. Busyness can often be a way of avoiding deep introspection, deep understanding of oneself and one situation, I think. It's actually easy to be busy, or easier to be busy sometimes than to sit quietly. Now, there are some resonances or perspectives, I think, that I've found between this approach and the Zen practice that I try to follow, in that ultimate truth or wisdom is not seen as the product only of the rational mind that makes judgmental decisions, even though they may be very useful. That a rational mind can be a great help in many situations, of course, but it's not the be-all and end-all of how to guide our lives. Rather, it's important also to let go of the attachment to the ego-centered cognitive conceptual mind, as we were reminded in the excerpt that we have of Faith in Mind, or Faith Mind, that we read this morning or recited this morning. The great way is not difficult, it says, just avoid picking and choosing. Only when you neither long nor loathe does it clearly relieve itself. To see its truth, be neither for nor against. Conflicts between liking and disliking are disease of the mind. Gain and loss, right and wrong, away with them once and for all. Now, I saw part of this quoted by a writer of what seems to me is probably a very interesting book in the United States. I must own up, I didn't have time to read it. I am going to get it, I think. It's actually called The Fire Monks. And it's an inquiry into the small group of monks, of novice monks, who stayed in the Tassawara Monastery in Southern California in 2008, when the bushfires approached and ultimately burned some of the buildings in the monastery. And the writer, who's also a Zen practitioner, wrote, in reflecting on what she'd learned, "We have little tolerance for uncertainty, which makes us feel small and vulnerable. But the evidence is in. A mind that won't tolerate uncertainty is a mind easily misled. Zazen fosters a willingness to be with the unknown, an opening of the gates of perception, a posture that is firm and alert, but not stiff or closed off. From this flexible place, it's possible to chart a wise course, moment by moment. You have to let go of wanting anything at all. And then a world of options opens up." So she wrote a book based on the interviewings, as close to the interview of these, I believe it was 8 fire monks who had been trained in bushfire prevention, and well, of fighting bushfires, dealing with bushfires, and who elected to stay with the monastery. I think at one point they were just about to leave, and they reinforced their commitment to staying there. And I, from what I gather, the book unpacks the lives, the individual and collective lives, and and ideals of the small group of monks who stayed with the monastery. Anyway, that's something to do for the future. So what it seems to me, what the Quaker advice seems to do in Zen terms is provide a method for bracketing or suspending the ego-driven mind of pride, guilt, and busyness. And in the committee of clearance tradition, with the help of others, relinquishing the attachment to specific outcomes. And that's done by contacting an inner teacher that's comfortable with the unknown and the unknowable. Teacher that honors, in Zen terms, the beginner's mind.